Welcome back to Against the Grain. My name is Dr. Samir Kakodkar. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease.
Can baking soda treat Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis? The answer is we don't know yet, but there may be a mechanism to explain how it theoretically could be anti-inflammatory and possibly helpful for autoimmune disease. Today I spoke with Dr. Paul O'Connor, who recently published some very interesting work on the anti-inflammatory effects of baking soda, something that you probably have in your fridge right now. However, as a disclaimer, this is not an endorsement or recommendation to use baking soda for inflammatory bowel disease, as it has not been FDA approved for that purpose and has not been studied in the form of a randomized controlled trial, which admittedly would be a lot easier to do than some of the other treatments discussed in other episodes, so I am optimistic that it will eventually be done. You can also contact me in case you have any questions about this podcast or if you'd like to make an appointment to see me. My email is samir3@gmail.com. So today we have Dr. Paul O'Connor, who has done some very interesting research regarding baking soda and its effect on the immune system. And I had reached out to him because I had read his article and saw in the discussion that there was some suggestion that maybe this could have applications to autoimmune disease, particularly inflammatory bowel disease. So, Dr. O'Connor, thanks for coming on. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came about studying baking soda?
So I'm a basic scientist. I have a PhD in physiology. I studied physiology and immunology at Monash University in Australia before moving to the US in 2005, where I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and now I run an independent research laboratory at the Medical College of Georgia, or Augusta University in Augusta, Georgia. In regards to baking soda, how we started studying that. So my lab's primarily interested in chronic kidney disease. So I was trained as a renal physiologist, and one of the things that happens in chronic kidney disease. So our kidneys, their job physiologically is really to balance output of electrolytes with input, and one of the sort of electrolytes we balance is bicarbonate or acid. And what happens is when you have kidney disease, once you lose enough renal mass, it's very common for these patients, so you've lost a lot of your kidney function, for them not to be able to excrete an appropriate acid load or the amount of acid that we take in through our diet. So what happens is their body begins to become acidic, which actually means you have a fall in plasma bicarbonate levels. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. So clinically, this can lead to a number of deleterious sequelae, bone wasting, fatigue, a number of problems. So in order to prevent these downstream sequelae of the acidosis from the chronic kidney disease, it's quite common now to give these patients sodium bicarbonate in their diet to supplement. So they just take pills with sodium bicarbonate to bring their acid-base status back to normal. One of the interesting findings, there's been a number of small clinical studies done on this, and one of the interesting findings is not only did it help with these downstream sequelae, but it actually slowed the progression of chronic kidney disease itself. And this was an unexpected finding, and no one really understands how supplementing these patients with bicarbonate slows the progression of chronic kidney disease. So this is a disease that we can't stop. It slowly progresses in all these individuals. Mm-hmm. So my lab, that's how we got interested in it. We were interested in, how, as a basic science lab, can we investigate how bicarbonate is working to slow the progression of chronic kidney disease? And that's really where we started from.
Okay. And the reason that I stumbled upon your work is, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there's a lot of message boards and news sites that kind of picked up on your study and it's been in the news. Are you aware of this, that people are talking? And I'm not sure if they're making certain claims about baking soda, and we'll get into your research as well, but I just wanted to know, are you aware of kind of the news buzz that's been going on about your study?
Yeah, I mean, so quite often when we publish a study, the Dean's Office here will ask us to write a little media release for it. Mm-hmm. And certainly I got contacted by a number of people in the months or weeks after we submitted that. And I think primarily not regarding the science of it so much, but the use of baking soda as an anti-inflammatory agent really got people interested. I'm aware that it's been taken and posted around. And unfortunately, it sometimes makes it difficult to get the message across that we want to get out rather than because it was initially a scientific message, but it's taken to all sorts of places.
Sure. And that's the reason I wanted to contact you and have you on to, you know, give your perspective as opposed to, you know, and I've seen on, particularly in inflammatory bowel disease forums, I've actually seen people trying to use baking soda. And I think what the appeal is with autoimmune diseases, a lot of the medications that are being used are very involved. Like they're usually infusions or injections that are very expensive, take a huge process to get approved. And the notion that potentially something that's just in your refrigerator could be helpful for these conditions is very appealing. And it's something that people have readily available. So can you briefly explain, you know, what you did with baking soda in your study and pretty much like the basic results? And this is more for, you know, a clinician audience as well as like a lay audience. I know we're not, I'm assuming most of the people listening are not PhDs and probably can't understand the physiology to the degree that you can. But if you can do your best to simplify it so that clinicians and lay people can understand what the findings of your study were.
Okay, so I mean, we started off. We have a rat model of chronic kidney disease. This is something called the Dahl salt sensitive rat, and it's an animal model that's been bred. So when you feed it a high salt diet, it gets high blood pressure or hypertension, and it also gets spontaneous kidney disease. So we decided to we'll see if bicarbonate slows the progression of kidney disease in this animal model, and then maybe we can use this model as a way to figure out how it's working. So that's how we started. So we just simply took our kidney disease rat model and started putting 0.1 molar, which is a sort of a bicarbonate solution in their drinking water versus sodium chloride solution, because we wanted to give them the same salt load, because sodium chloride itself may have some effects. And then let them drink this over a two-week period, and then we took the kidneys from these animals and looked at them histologically to see if we had any protection from injury. When we were doing this in kidney disease field, it's very clear now that the immune system is involved in the progression of a number of kidney diseases. So we actually sent off samples from some of these animals that we've been treating with bicarbonate or with our control solution to an immunologist who works with us on campus, and he ran just a basic panel of immune cells. So immune cells, of course, they're known that they participate in inflammatory conditions or inflammatory disease, but the immune system also regulates the resolution of inflammation. So when you have an injury, you get that swelling and soreness. That's the pro-inflammatory stage, but it also goes away. So that's the resolution of inflammation, and both of those sides are regulated by the immune system. What we found in the kidney, and there's markers for these individual types of immune cells that regulate both these parts of inflammation, that the immune cells that regulate resolution were upregulated in the kidneys of animals treated with bicarbonate compared to sodium chloride, and the immune cells that are pro-inflammatory or that initial inflammatory stage were downregulated. So we initially thought, well, perhaps this is just a different injury in the kidney of these animals. So we went and did it in an animal model that doesn't have kidney disease, and we saw the same thing. So this shift in polarization towards an anti-inflammatory environment in regard to the immune cells, and what flow cytometry, I say, really counts the immune cells in a tissue that show one of these markers or the other. Mm-hmm. So that sort of got us thinking, what is it about the sodium bicarbonate that is promoting this anti-inflammatory environment in the kidneys of these animal models? Mm-hmm. Because it seems to be not associated with any resolution of injury or anything like that. So it was happening directly from the sodium bicarbonate, we thought, or at least it didn't require changes in injury in the kidneys. So we did some follow-up studies to work out where these immune cells were coming from. It turned out they're coming from the spleen. So if you remove the spleens of these animals weeks before you run these studies, you don't see this anti-inflammatory response of sodium bicarbonate. Mm. And we also, again, because sodium bicarbonate's we could use that in a clinical study. We have another group here at the Georgia Prevention Institute who was sort of our translational arm, and I was talking to one of my colleagues in that group, and they said, well, that's something we could do in healthy individuals and see if we can see these similar immune changes. Mm-hmm. So we organised a very small study where we had healthy human subjects come in. We gave them about the same concentration of sodium bicarbonate to drink, which worked out to be 2 grams in 250 mils of bottled water. These are fasted individuals. They come in the morning. We do a baseline. We just took venous blood. Of course, we can't take their kidneys or their spleens. They drank either a sodium chloride solution or a sodium bicarbonate solution, and then we took blood on the hour for the next 3 hours after that, and again sent those blinded samples off to our immunologist, and he sent us back the data, and we could see the same change, and the cells we looked at were called macrophages, but this anti-inflammatory shift in the cells of these healthy individuals as well. So that's sort of the real basis that got us interested in, and since then we've been looking at the pathways involved and how it actually works. But certainly we saw pretty robust evidence that drinking sodium bicarbonate, whether you're a rat or a healthy human subject, promoted this anti-inflammatory shift in the immune profile of cells, either in the blood or in the kidney or spleen.
And that's a very key point there, that there are a lot of studies on mouse models that, you know, prove a certain mechanistic basis of a treatment or a certain effect. But sometimes when we translate that to human studies, we don't see the same effects. But here you're seeing the exact same effect in both in animal model and in humans. So that lends further credence to this maybe being helpful. But an important point is this was done in healthy subjects, not people with inflammatory bowel disease. So it's yet to be proven that it would have that effect in somebody who has like a dysregulated immune system at baseline.
Correct. We haven't in my lab done any studies in any inflammatory condition. It's not actually something we generally study. Mm-hmm. We're certainly not trying to get across the point that this cures inflammatory disease or dental thing. It promotes an anti-inflammatory cell polarization in healthy individuals and in various rat models of disease. But right. We haven't looked at it in inflammatory disease.
And that's very interesting because a lot of these news sites and these blog sites have been saying, oh, like treat your rheumatoid arthritis by drinking baking soda, and this may be helpful, but these are making extrapolations without, you know, really proving that this is effective. But it's definitely a very interesting effect and something that needs further study in the future. So you talked about the polarization of macrophages, which are a type of immune cell, from the M1 to the M2, which is more of an anti-inflammatory kind of population. And there is some data to suggest in Crohn's disease that there is more of a polarization towards M1. So that does make sense mechanistically. And you do talk about this cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway. Can you talk a little bit more about that pathway and how that works as far as leading to less inflammation?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's really scientifically a lot of the interest in this. So around 20 years ago, Kevin Tracy's group at the Feinstein Institute in New York, so Kevin Tracy's a neurosurgeon and a neuroscientist, and he reported that if you stimulate the vagus nerve, which is this big rest and digest nerve in our body, it activates an anti-inflammatory response. Mm-hmm. They then went on to show that the anti-inflammatory response from electrically stimulating the vagus nerve is predominantly a systemic response, predominantly occurs from the spleen. So if you remove the spleen from animals, they don't have an anti-inflammatory response, just as we saw with bicarbonate in rats. Mm-hmm. This was a bit of a conundrum for that field because the vagus nerve itself is relatively well accepted that it doesn't go to the spleen. Mm-hmm. So there's been a controversy over the last 10 or 15 years of how no one doubts that stimulating the vagus nerve activates an anti-inflammatory response in the spleen, but they wonder how it gets there since the vagus nerve doesn't go there.
Mm-hmm.
So in this field that sort of moved, they now think that it might synapse with the sympathetic nervous system, which does go to the spleen, although this has been disputed by other data. So again, it's very controversial. But they've actually moved this forward. I mean, this is one area where they have done a lot of studies in inflammatory disease models, preclinical studies, and shown a lot of benefit. And there's actually a number of ongoing clinical trials, one in Crohn's disease and one multi-site trial in rheumatoid arthritis, where they're actually implanting electrical stimulators on people's cervical vagus to treat these inflammatory conditions.
Mm-hmm.
What we realised when we're giving bicarbonate, we realised that, one, the anti-inflammatory response was also coming from the spleen, which got us interested in the spleen. And then, two, we had this sort of serendipitous finding when we did our splenectomy animals to try and remove the spleen to show that the anti-inflammatory response was coming from the spleen or to determine if it was coming from the spleen. It turned out that our control surgery in that initial study, which was just to move the spleen towards midline and then put it back so we didn't take it out of the animals, mm-hmm. Also completely abolished the anti-inflammatory effect to bicarbonate. So this made us look really closely at how that very simple surgical manoeuvre of just moving the spleen could do that. And we found these mesothelial connections that stained up for neuronal markers. These mesothelial cells proliferated when you broke these connections. And, of course, when we broke these connections, we lost the anti-inflammatory response. So we actually think that what we've found is potentially how this signal gets to the spleen if it doesn't come through the vagus nerve. And it actually comes from the gastrointestinal tract through the peritoneal mesothelial cells to the spleen. So we think we may have helped solve some of that controversy in that field.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really interesting when you think about that, well, one of the things that the vagus nerve stimulation is really well known for is stimulating acid secretion in the stomach.
Right.
And it's exactly the same thing sodium bicarbonate does. So we think the actual stimuli might be related to acid secretion in the stomach, which is sort of telling your body there may be some antigens coming, you've just had a meal. And that signals the immune system through this pathway. So we think we may have inadvertently sort of stumbled on some of the mechanisms of how this cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway, and that field's far more advanced than the idea of bicarbonate.
Sure. Now that's very interesting, how you came about this mechanism of the connection without directly looking for it. But it does bring up some points, because another thing that you mentioned in the paper was that using a proton pump inhibitor, like these medications that are over the counter now, like Nexium or Prilosec, using that, I believe in the rat model, also abolished the effect of the baking soda. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So, I mean, we've done some studies since then that we're aware that it really isn't the effect, and I think this is part of those media reports as well sometimes get away, the effect isn't because we're alkalinizing the body. In healthy individuals and healthy rats, you don't alkalinize the body when you give sodium bicarbonate.
Okay.
Because the kidneys get rid of that extra alkali load. What we think the effect is mediated by, it's related to acid secretion in the stomach, because, yes, we can block it with a proton pump inhibitor, and we can also metabolic alkali, we've given sodium citrate, which doesn't act as a buffer in the stomach, but when it gets through the liver, it turns into bicarbonate.
Mm-hmm.
That has no effect to activate this pathway. So we're reasonably certain now that the response is related to acid secretion in the stomach.
I see. So the baking soda presumably, you know, would neutralize some of that acid, but completely, wouldn't you expect that if you would abolish the acid secretion that the effect would be more potentiated, or you'd have more of an effect if you stopped acid secretion, or am I thinking about that wrong?
I think, yeah, so it's an example. So bicarbonate gets rid of the acidity of the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so the stomach's normally at pH 2 or 3. You drink a bicarbonate solution, the stomach pH goes up to about 7. So then what has to happen is your parietal cells have to start secreting acid to bring stomach pH back down to normal.
Mm-hmm.
If you stimulate the vagus nerve, that directly stimulates these cells to secrete acid. Mm-hmm. If you give a proton pump inhibitor, it inhibits that acid secretion. So we don't think it's the common denominator is not how you get the acid to be secreted. It's the secretion of acid itself is stimulating this response somehow.
Okay. And then the other question I had is, I'm not aware of any association. I could be wrong. I haven't actually looked into this in detail, but patients who've had splenectomies just for other reasons, either due to trauma, sometimes if you have sickle cell disease, you end up getting splenectomies. Are those people more prone to autoimmune disease? I'm not aware, or immune dysregulation. I know they're more prone to infections, specifically with encapsulated bacteria, and they require a whole set of vaccines. But I'm not. It seems like the spleen is necessary for this particular mechanism to work. But I'm not aware of splenectomized patients having more immune dysregulation.
Yeah, I mean, so I can't speak too intelligently on the topic. I will say that as well as being a source of anti-inflammatory cells in response to this stimuli, the spleen is the main source of inflammatory cells. So it has a dual role.
Okay.
So at least in regards to the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway, this was initially discovered in septic animals where they'd given endotoxin to create a septic shock model. In the absence of the spleen, the inflammatory cells aren't there either. So it can produce both inflammatory cells and anti-inflammatory cells. I can't speak to it in autoimmune disease and what the data might show about people with splenectomies and the rate of autoimmune disorders.
Sure. Okay. And then you mentioned that the baking soda is not really inducing a metabolic alkalosis. So it seems like if you have healthy kidneys, they're able to address this bicarbonate load, and you don't really become have a metabolic alkalosis from this. Is that correct?
I mean, it shouldn't. It's like this is the danger of these things. Everything's dose dependent. Mm-hmm. I mean, our kidneys can balance our pH, whether you're taking an acid diet or an alkaline diet, without your internal environment changing very much. That's the whole point of homeostasis and what the kidneys are doing.
Right.
Of course, if you take too much alkaline, you're going to overwhelm this system, and that can be incredibly dangerous.
Sure.
But in the normal healthy, we did blood gas measurements in our animals and in the clinical study. We don't see changes in blood acid base status, and we wouldn't expect to, because we know these are healthy individuals and they can excrete the load we gave them. But the danger of this is that, okay, well, a little bit of bicarbonate's good. Is more better? Well, more might overwhelm your ability of your kidneys to get rid of it. And there's also, that's not the only danger of taking sodium bicarbonate. But certainly in a healthy individual, a small amount of sodium bicarbonate shouldn't upset your acid base status.
Sure. And just to go off topic a little bit, there is this kind of conflict I've noticed. You know, I myself am trained in Western medicine, allopathic medicine, but, you know, in other kind of alternative medicine fields, there is this concept of, having an alkaline body prevents disease or prevents you from developing cancer. I've heard this mentioned, but, you know, what I learned in medical school and what's traditionally taught is that as long as you have a healthy set of kidneys, as far as like being, I mean, for the most part, your body's very good at maintaining this pH of about 7.4. And when you go off of that, your body has ways of maintaining the right pH. But I've seen, particularly in the inflammatory bowel disease community, there are certain people using things like they sell alkaline water, which I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, but alkaline water, as well as there's something called Kangen water that some people have, at least on the internet, reported they've had some success with drinking tons of this. And that's another type of alkalinized water. So you can get water now at the store where the pH is, you know, I believe, significantly above 7. I don't know if it's like an 8 or something like that, 8 or 9. Do you think that would have a similar effect as the baking soda, or would that not be expected to do anything?
No. So we have been asked about this, and I had so when you think about pH, you've got to think about two things, not just what the pH is or what the concentration of acid is, mm-hmm. but what the buffering capacity of that solution is. So water doesn't have any buffers in it, so if I add a tiny amount of alkali to it, its pH will very quickly become alkaline.
Sure.
But when I drink that, it does almost nothing to my stomach acid because there really wasn't a lot of alkali in it.
Oh, okay.
The amount of alkali we're talking about, even though the pH is probably the same, about 7 or 8, mm-hmm. our solution is about 6,000 times more concentrated than what you'd get in a bottle of alkaline water. So it makes your stomach secrete about 6,000 times more acid to be able to get that response. So I don't think alkali water has anything to do with anything, really. And it certainly, I can say it's definitely a much weaker solution than what we're using. Mm-hmm. In terms of its buffering capacity, even though the pH is probably similar, but from our data, it wouldn't activate the anti-inflammatory response.
Okay, that's very great to hear, because you know I think a lot of people are buying that, and it's probably maybe they're expecting some health benefits based on these questionable claims about alkalinizing the body and things on effects.
Yeah,
on your
it certainly doesn't alkalize the body. I mean, yeah. If you're a healthy individual, even if you're acidic, I don't think alkaline water would alkalize your body.
Right. Okay. So you talked about activating this cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway, the vagal nerve. Are you aware of this Wim Hof method? Wim Hof is a man who has done a lot of amazing feats. He's climbed Mount Everest without, like, in his shorts, without the use of oxygen. He's swam under glaciers. He's done a lot of things that most people would think are not possible. But he also claims to be able to control his immune system, and he does it through a combination of breathing exercises and cold exposure. And there are publications to suggest he's been able to train other people to do the same. And one of the things he does is hyperventilate. That's like a main part of his program. I've gone through his program and have experimented with it myself. And one of the main things is hyperventilating and then holding your breath and then being exposed to cold. Have you heard of this? And is this something that would make sense as far as activating the similar pathway that you've discovered?
So, no, I'm unaware of it.
Okay.
I think in regards, I mean, that's sort of one of the research questions we have at the moment is, well, this cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway was traditionally the vagal anti-inflammatory pathway, so this parasympathetic nervous pathway. And there's lots of people talk about, well, how do you activate your parasympathetic nervous system? One of the things we've got to realize is we sometimes group things very, very categorically, but the vagus activates different organs at different times. So you don't have stomach acid secretion at the same time as you have a slowed heart rate or you have an erection, for example. So all of these things are regulated by the parasympathetic nervous system. Mm-hmm. But just because an athlete has high parasympathetic activity and a slow heart rate doesn't mean these other things are going on at the same time. So it's regulated independently. So this idea of just looking at general parasympathetic tone, I'm not sure is correct.
Okay.
And we don't know what we think now is perhaps this anti-inflammatory pathway isn't really, yes, you can activate it by stimulating the vagus nerve, but that might just be because it stimulates acid secretion. There may be other ways. It may really be a gastrointestinal splenic mechanism, and there's other ways to activate it, for example, the sodium bicarbonate. So that's one of the questions we are really interested in at the moment, because what's the best way therapeutically to try and activate this pathway? Is it vagal nerve stimulation, or is it some gastrointestinal stimuli?
Okay. Another thing people have mentioned or tried is regarding influencing the parasympathetic tone is this heart rate variability training. And I think you had
I can't say no to that, but I suspect it's more specific. And that we're not really, vagal tone to the heart may not be the same as vagal tone to the stomach or vagal tone to other parts.
Sure. No, that makes sense. That's something I've experimented with as well. Nowadays, they do sell these kind of biofeedback machines and small devices that kind of train you to be more in a parasympathetic state based on your heart rate variability, which is a measure of that, to maximize that variability. But, I get what you're saying. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that's going to translate to, for example, the inflammation of Crohn's disease. They may just be independent things. One of the concerns that some people have about taking baking soda is the effect on blood pressure, because it is a sodium load. But my understanding, in your study, you didn't notice any effects on blood pressure.
So, I mean, we're a kidney disease group, so blood pressure is one of the things we really look at pretty closely. The relationship between salt and blood pressure is probably a little bit more complex than most people realize anyway. Some people mm-hmm. have, you know, most of us have really high salt diets, and plenty of us still have normal blood pressure. There's some people that are salt sensitive, some that aren't. Mm-hmm. And that means when you increase your salt intake, or generally in the Western population, when you lower your salt intake, you see a change in your blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Most people don't see much of a change, most people being about 2/3 of the hypertensive population. So there's still plenty of people that are salt sensitive.
Okay.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, this is one of what we don't want to happen is people to take a basic science study and then run with it and say, well, this is good for me. I mean, there's lots of things to take into consideration about what could go wrong with this type of treatment.
Sure.
Salt is one of them. Certainly, there's many people that you don't want increasing their salt load, because it can be dangerous, can increase blood pressure. There may be ways around that, but we didn't see blood pressure change in our study, but they were healthy human subjects. And in our animal model, we didn't see it in one, but we did in the other. But that's an animal model that's bred to be salt sensitive. So it you could have an increase in blood pressure from taking sodium bicarbonate. It's a big sodium load. The 2 grams a day is a significant portion of your sodium intake, daily sodium intake.
Right, which is pretty much the maximum that's nowadays recommended for people with high blood pressure or other conditions where you need to limit your sodium. So if you're getting all of that load from that, then anything additional you get in food or drinks would be in addition
yes.
to that.
Yeah.
So another concern I had about baking soda was the microbiome. And in inflammatory bowel disease, particularly Crohn's, and ulcerative colitis, the microbiome is known to be less biodiverse. And part of what modulates the microbiome is acid. Acid is, again, one of our defense mechanisms against enteric infections and probably influences the microbiome. We know that people who take proton pump inhibitors are more at risk for C. diff, Clostridium difficile infections. And we know there is some data of an association between proton pump inhibitors and potentially changes patients with Crohn's having to change their medication or histamine 2 blockers and potentially flares of IBD. But those are just associations that has not been proven out. But that is one concern I had. It was like if somebody took baking soda for a long period of time, that it may affect the microbiome. I don't know if you had any comments about that, but.
Certainly. So, you know, the acid, the low pH of our stomach is protective against certain bacteria. And certainly that gets through to the lower parts. I guess the answer is quite possibly. When you're on a proton pump inhibitor, it's a little different in that you're suppressing acid secretion mm-hmm. all day.
Right.
If you drink sodium bicarbonate, you probably have an increased pH of your stomach for 45 minutes or so. So it's not an all-day thing.
Okay.
So that may allow you to take it without having that risk, but we certainly don't know. And certainly we didn't look at the chronic use in human subjects. It's not something we've got anywhere near yet. We haven't looked at it therapeutically. Does it actually work against disease? So there's all of these questions that I think are legitimate questions that have to be answered before you'd use this as a therapeutic approach.
Sure. So what are the next steps here after your findings and Are you confident enough in your findings where you think it should be tested for certain autoimmune conditions, and where do you think we should start?
I mean, I can tell you, our interest at the moment is deciding whether or not how bicarbonate's activating this cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway. Is it the same pathway activated by the vagal nerve, which we think it is? Mm-hmm. And is it really coming through the mesothelial cells? Because as I said, there's already clinical trials going on with vagal nerve stimulation.
Right.
Perhaps that's not the right way to go about it. Perhaps there's a much simpler way. Mm-hmm. So that's where our efforts are looking. Certainly, we think it's worth looking in, we're looking in some models of inflammatory disease, although not autoimmune disease, in animal models to look at the efficacy of giving sodium bicarbonate. But all of these things start with sort of a wave of preclinical studies before people get interested in trying to do a large clinical trial with it. So we're still in the early stages. This was the first study published in April. Really on this topic. So we're probably a little while away before we can get the momentum, if it makes it past all those hurdles, to try and do a clinical study.
Sure. And, you know, whenever a new treatment comes out that seems to have some promise or some theoretical benefit, I like to zoom out and try to understand why that would be the case, like evolutionarily. Why would taking baking soda lead to this effect? And I think you mentioned it earlier where you said that maybe what this is doing is it's you mentioned something about potentially it's making the body think there isn't an invader that it needs to defend against. Is that correct? Or what do you think?
I'm speculating
sure.
entirely. Now, I mean, when you talk about evolution, I guess that's all you can do. But
yeah.
We know the peritoneal cavity is a really at-risk environment for infections.
Sure.
So you can have, and it's lined with macrophages. You can have antigens coming in, either following a meal, or they could come in from a bacteria from the gastrointestinal tract, or you could have spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. Something going on in there. Mm-hmm. So how does your immune system know how to respond? Well, if you have antigens coming in from a meal, how does your body know you just ate a meal? Well, perhaps this is, and then again, it's only speculation, but what we know, what we think we know, is that stimulation of acid secretion, which happens during meals, is driving the immune system to promote an anti-inflammatory cell polarization. So perhaps what the physiological mechanism that normally represents is something to tell the immune system to dampen down on antigens that are absorbed after a meal, as opposed if you had a bacterial infection, you're getting antigens being presented to this same region, but there's no gastric acid secretion prior to this.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a pro-inflammatory response. So that's what we're speculating it might be, and maybe we can take advantage of that by stimulating a lot of acid secretion, more than you get during a regular meal, to really dampen down the inflammatory response in people whose immune profile is already shifted to a pro-inflammatory side. I mean, that's sort of the underlying hypothesis that we have, but I mean, when you're talking about those types of things, you're just really speculating.
Sure. And there are people who do take, again, this is unproven, but take supplements like HCL supplements. I think it's called betaine HCL, and for a variety of conditions, but inflammatory bowel disease is one of them, which presumably would be additional acid, and potentially that may be the mechanism of how that's helping people, but that's unproven. Okay, so and then another thought I just had as you were mentioning this is there are disease states where there's too much acid secretion. You know, people can have Zollinger or Ellison syndrome or gastrinomas where they produce too much gastrin, the hormone that promotes acid secretion. Those people tend to develop ulcers in the stomach and sometimes throughout the small intestine. So it's interesting to see that's kind of the other spectrum of it when you're producing extreme amounts of acid. I'm not aware of any studies looking into if those patients, like their immune profile, or if that condition may be protective against other immune diseases or even like kidney disease.
Yeah, I mean, on that, I doubt people have looked. But what I will say, that again, that's why we're really interested in, well, should we be stimulating the vagus or giving sodium bicarbonate? Because too much acid secretion can damage the lining.
Sure.
The benefit of bicarbonate is you're not lowering pH too much. You're bringing it back to normal once it was raised. Mm-hmm. So you don't have that problem with the lining, although you can have problems with absorbing drugs that need an acid environment, or, as you said, potentially bacteria getting through that don't normally get through because their environment's too alkaline. So all of these things have to be taken into consideration. But I don't think people have probably recognised there's a link there, and hopefully our study sort of starts to bring that to light if there is. But yeah, perhaps there is a link between these acid people that secrete too much acid, and then maybe they're protective. We don't know. Hmm.
Well, thank you for doing your work. This study has really, I think, opened a lot of avenues for research, and hopefully you go further with this and discover more, and potentially, hopefully, there can be applications to particularly inflammatory bowel disease. But it's obviously we cannot recommend this treatment until it's really been tested formally in like a randomized controlled trial. But I still like to speak to people, because part of the reason for this podcast is just to get this message out directly from the source, and not having, you know, these blog websites or news websites kind of make claims about things that are not true. But definitely very promising results, and I hope they're borne out and when eventually this hopefully is tested in inflammatory bowel disease.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, and thank you for having me. It's always exciting to get a chance to talk about our results to people that are interested.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Smith.